Adolin looked as if he wanted to linger, but Dalinar gestured for him to leave. Dalinar looked down at the picture of the chasm fiend again, unsatisfied. What had he gained from the conversation? More vague hints? What could be so important about Yasna's research that she would ignore threats to the kingdom? He would have to compose a more forthright letter to her once he'd made his announcement, explaining why he had decided to step down. Perhaps that would bring her back. And in a moment of shock, Dalinar realized that he had made his decision. Sometime between leaving the trench and now, he'd stopped treating his abdication as an if, and started thinking of it as a when. It was the right decision. He felt sick about it, but certain. A man sometimes needed to do things that were unpleasant. It was the discussion with Yasna, he realized. The talk of her father. He was acting like Gavilar at the end. That had nearly undermined the kingdom. Well, he needed to stop himself before he got that far. Perhaps whatever was happening to him was some kind of disease of the mind, inherited from their parents. It...
You are quite fond of Yasna,
Navani said. Dalinar started, turning away from the picture of the chasm fiend. He'd assumed she'd followed Adolin out, but she still stood there, looking at him.
Why is it, Navani said, that you encourage her so strongly to return?
He turned to face Navani and realized that she'd sent her two youthful attendants out with the clerks. They were now alone. Navani, he said, this is inappropriate.
Bah, we're family and I have questions.
Dalinar hesitated, then walked to the center of the room. Navani stood near the door. Blessedly, her attendants had left open the door at the end of the antechamber, and beyond it were two guards in the hall outside. It wasn't an ideal situation, but so long as Dalinar could see the guards and they him, his conversation with Navani was just barely proper.
Dalinar?
Navani asked.
Are you going to answer me? Why is it you trust my daughter so much when others almost universally revile her?
I consider their disdain for her to be a recommendation, he said.
She is a heretic.
She refused to join any of the devotaries because she did not believe in their teachings. Rather than compromise for the sake of appearances, she has been honest and has refused to make professions she does not believe. I find that a sign of honor. Navani snorted.
You two are a pair of nails in the same doorframe. Stern, hard, and storming annoying to pull free.
You should go now, Dalinar said, nodding toward the hallway. He suddenly felt very exhausted. People will talk.
Let them. We need to plan, Dalinar. You are the most important High Prince in...
Navani, he cut in. I'm going to abdicate in favor of Adolin. She blinked in surprise. I'm stepping down as soon as I can make the necessary arrangements. It will be a few days at most. Speaking the words felt odd, as if saying them made his decision real. Navani looked pained.
Oh, Dalinar, she whispered. This is a terrible mistake.
It is mine to make, and I must repeat my request. I have many things to think about, Navani, and I can't deal with you right now. He pointed at the doorway. Navani rolled her eyes, but left as requested. She shut the door behind her.
That's it, Dalinar thought, letting out a long exhalation. I've made the decision.
Too weary to remove his plate unassisted, he sank down onto the floor, resting his head back against the wall. He would tell Adolin of his decision in the morning, then announce it at a feast within the week. From there, he would return to Alethkar and his lands. It was over. The end of Part 2.
Interludes. Rissen. Axes. Zeth. I-4. Rissen. Rissen hesitantly stepped down from the caravan's lead wagon. Her feet fell on soft, uneven ground that sank down a little beneath her. That made her shiver, particularly since the too-thick grass didn't move away as it should. Rissen tapped her foot a few times. The grass didn't so much as quiver.
"It's not going to move," Vestim said. "Grass here doesn't behave the way it does elsewhere. Surely you've heard that."
The older man sat beneath the bright yellow canopy of the lead wagon. He rested one arm on the side rail, holding a set of ledgers with the other hand. One of his long white eyebrows was tucked behind his ear, and he let the other trail down beside his face. He preferred stiffly starched robes, blue and red, and a flat-topped conical hat. It was classic Thalen merchant's clothing, several decades out of date, yet still distinguished.
"I've heard of the grass," Rissen said to him. "But it's just so odd."
She stepped again, walking in a circle around the lead wagon. Yes, she'd heard of the grass here in Shinovar, but she'd assumed that it would just be lethargic, that people said it didn't disappear because it moved too slowly. But no, that wasn't it. It didn't move at all. How did it survive? Shouldn't it have all been eaten away by animals? She shook her head in wonder, looking up across the plain. The grass completely covered it. The blades were all crowded together and you couldn't see the ground. What a mess it was.
"The ground is springy," she said, rounding back to her original side of the wagon. "Not just because of the grass."
"Hmm," Vestim said, still working on his ledgers. "Yes, it's called soil."
"It makes me feel like I'm going to sink down to my knees. How can the Shin stand living here?"
"They're an interesting people. Shouldn't you be setting up the device?"
Rissen sighed, but walked to the rear of the wagon. The other wagons in the caravan, six in all, were pulling up and forming a loose circle. She took down the tailgate of the lead wagon and heaved, pulling out a wooden tripod nearly as tall as she was. She carried it over one shoulder, marching to the center of the grassy circle. She was more fashionable than her Babsk. She wore the most modern of clothing for a young woman her age, a deep blue patterned silk vest over a light green long-sleeved shirt with stiff cuffs. Her ankle-length skirt, also green, was stiff and businesslike, utilitarian in cut, but embroidered for fashion. She wore a green glove on her left hand. Covering the safe hand was a silly tradition, just a result of Vorin cultural dominance, but it was best to keep up appearances. Many of the more traditional Thalen people, including, unfortunately, her Babsk, still found it scandalous for a woman to go about with her safe hand uncovered. She set up the tripod. It had been 5 months since Vestim became her Babsk, and she his apprentice. He'd been good to her. Not all Babsk were. By tradition, he was more than just her master. He was her father, legally, until he pronounced her ready to become a merchant on her own. She did wish he wouldn't spend so much time traveling to such odd places. He was known as a great merchant, and she'd assumed that great merchants would be the ones visiting exotic cities and ports, not ones who'd traveled to empty meadows in backward countries. Tripod set up, she returned to the wagon to fetch the fabrial. The wagon back formed an enclosure with thick sides and top to offer protection against high storms. Even the weaker ones in the west could be dangerous, at least until one got through the passes and into Shinovar. She hurried back to the tripod with the fabrial's box. She slid off the wooden top and removed the large heliodor inside. The pale yellow gemstone, at least 2 inches in diameter, was fixed inside a metal framework. It glowed gently, not as bright as one might expect of such a sizable gem. She set it in the tripod, then spun a few of the dials underneath, setting the fabrial to the people in the caravan.
Then she pulled a stool from the wagon and sat down to watch. She'd been astonished at what Vestim had paid for the device, one of the new, recently invented types that would give warning if people approached. Was it really so important? She sat back, looking up at the gemstone, watching to see if it grew brighter. The odd grass of the Shin lands waved in the wind, stubbornly refusing to withdraw, even at the strongest of gusts. In the distance rose the white peaks of the misted mountains, sheltering Shinovar. Those mountains caused the high storms to break and fade, making Shinovar one of the only places in all of Roshar where high storms did not rain. The plain around her was dotted with strange, straight-trunked trees, with stiff skeletal branches full of leaves that didn't withdraw in the wind. The entire landscape had an eerie feel to it, as if it were dead. Nothing moved. With a start, Rissen realized she couldn't see any spren. Not a one. No wind spren, no life spren, nothing. It was as if the entire land were slow of wit. Like a man who was born without all his brains. One who didn't know when to protect himself, but instead just stared at the wall, drooling. She dug into the ground with a finger, then brought it up to inspect the soil, as Vestim had called it. It was dirty stuff. Why, a strong gust could uproot this entire field of grass and blow it away. Good thing the high storms couldn't reach these lands. Near the wagons, the servants and guards unloaded crates and set up camp. Suddenly, the Heliodor began to pulse with a brighter yellow light. "Master," she called, standing. "Someone's nearby." Vestim, who had been going through crates, looked up sharply. He waved to Killerm, head of the guards, and his six men got out their bows.
"There,"
one said, pointing. In the distance, a group of horsemen was approaching. They didn't ride very quickly, and they led several large animals, like thick, squat horses, pulling wagons. The gemstone in the fabrial pulsed more brightly as the newcomers got closer.
"Yes," Vestim said, looking at the fabrial. "That is going to be very handy. Good range on it."
"But we knew they were coming," Rissen said, rising from her stool and walking over to him.
"This time," he said. "But if it warns us of bandits in the dark, it'll repay its cost a dozen times over. Killerm, lower your bows. You know how they feel about those things."
The guards did as they were told, and the group of Thalens waited. Rissen found herself tucking her eyebrows back nervously, though she didn't know why she bothered. The newcomers were just Shin. Of course, Vestim insisted that she shouldn't think of them as savages. He seemed to have great respect for them. As they approached, she was surprised by the variety in their appearance. Other Shin she'd seen had worn basic brown robes or other workers' clothing. At the front of this group, however, was a man in what must be Shin finery, a bright, multicolored cloak that completely enveloped him, tied closed at the front. It trailed down on either side of his horse, drooping almost to the ground. Only his head was exposed. Four men rode on horses around him, and they wore more subdued clothing. Still bright, just not as bright. They wore shirts, trousers, and colorful capes. At least 36 other men walked alongside them wearing brown tunics. More drove the three large wagons.
"Wow," Rissen said. "He brought a lot of servants."
"Servants?" Vestim said.
"The fellows in brown," Herbabsk smiled.
"Those are his guards, child."
"What? They look so dull."
"Shin are a curious folk," he said. "Here, warriors are the lowliest of men, kind of like slaves. Men trade and sell them between houses by way of little stones that signify ownership, and any man who picks up a weapon must join them and be treated the same. The fellow in the fancy robe? He's a farmer."
"A landowner, you mean?"
"No. As far as I can tell, he goes out every day Well, the days when he's not overseeing a negotiation like this, and works the fields. They treat all farmers like that, lavish them with attention and respect.
Rissen gaped. But most villages are filled with farmers.
Indeed, Vistim said. Holy places here. Foreigners aren't allowed near fields or farming villages.
How strange, she thought. Perhaps living in this place has affected their minds. Killerm and his guards didn't look terribly pleased at being so heavily outnumbered, but Vistim didn't seem bothered. Once the Shin grew close, he walked out from his wagons without a hint of trepidation. Rissen hurried after him, her skirt brushing the grass below. Bother, she thought. Another problem with its not retracting. If she had to buy a new hem because of this dull grass, it was going to make her very cross. Vistim met up with the Shin, then bowed in a distinctive way, hands toward the ground.
Tanbalo Kentala, he said.
She didn't know what it meant. The man in the cloak, the farmer, nodded respectfully, and one of the other riders dismounted and walked forward.
Winds of fortune guide you, my friend.
He spoke Thalen very well.
He who adds is happy for your safe arrival. Thank you, Thresh, son Isan, Vistim said, and my thanks to he who adds. What have you brought for us from your strange lands, friend? Thresh said. More metal, I hope.
Vistim waved, and some of the guards brought over a heavy crate. They set it down and pried off the top, revealing its peculiar contents. Pieces of scrap metal, mostly shaped like bits of shell, though some were formed like pieces of wood. It looked to Rissen like garbage that had, for some inexplicable reason, been soul-cast into metal.
Ah, Thresh said, squatting down to inspect the box. Wonderful. Not a bit of it was mined, Vistim said. No rocks were broken or smelted to get this metal, Thresh. It was soul-cast from shells, bark, or branches. I have a document sealed by 5 separate Salen notaries attesting to it.
You needn't have done such a thing as this, Thresh said.
You have once earned our trust in this matter long ago. I'd rather be proper about it, Vistim said. A merchant who is careless with contracts is one who finds himself with enemies instead of friends.
Thresh stood up, clapping 3 times. The men in brown with the downcast eyes lowered the back of a wagon, revealing crates.
The others who visit us, Thresh noted, walking to the wagon. All they seem to care about are horses. Everyone wishes to buy horses, but never you, my friend. Why is that? Too hard to care for, Vistim said, walking with Thresh. And there's too often a poor return on the investment, valuable as they are. But not with these, Thresh said, picking up one of the light crates.
There was something alive inside.
Not at all, Vistim said. Chickens fetch a good price, and they're easy to care for, assuming you have feed. We brought you plenty, Thresh said. I cannot believe you buy these from us. They are not worth nearly so much as you outsiders think. And you give us metal for them. Metal that bears no stain of broken rock. A miracle.
Vistim shrugged.
Those scraps are practically worthless where I come from. They're made by ardents practicing with soul casters. They can make food, because if you get it wrong, it's poisonous. So they turn garbage into metal and throw it away. But it can be forged. Why forge the metal? Vistim said. When you can carve an object from wood in the precise shape you want, then soul cast it.
Thresh just shook his head, bemused. Rissen watched with her own share of confusion. This was the craziest trade exchange she'd ever seen. Normally, Vistim argued and haggled like a crush killer.
but here he freely revealed that his wares were worthless. In fact, as conversation proceeded, the two both took pains to explain how worthless their goods were. Eventually they came to an agreement, though Rissen couldn't grasp how, and shook hands on the deal. Some of Thresh's soldiers began to unload their boxes of chickens, cloth, and exotic dried meats. Others began carting away boxes of scrap metal.
"You couldn't trade me a soldier, could you?" Vestim asked as they waited. "They cannot be sold to an outsider, I am afraid. But there was that one you traded me." "It's been nearly 7 years," Thresh said with a laugh. "And still you ask?" "You don't know what I got for him," Vestim said. "And you gave him to me for practically nothing." "He was truthless," Thresh said, shrugging. "He wasn't worth anything at all. You forced me to take something in trade, though to confess I had to throw your payment into a river. I could not take money for a truthless." "Well, I suppose I can't take offense at that," Vestim said, rubbing his chin. "But if you ever have another, let me know. Best servant I ever had. I still regret that I traded him." "I will remember, friend," Thresh said. "But I do not think it likely we will have another like him."
He seemed to grow distracted.
"Indeed, I should hope that we never do."
Once the goods were exchanged, they shook hands again. Then Vestim bowed to the farmer. Rissen tried to mimic what he did, and earned a smile from Thresh and several of his companions, who chattered in their whispering Shin language. Such a long, boring ride for such a short exchange. But Vestim was right. Those chickens would be worth good spheres in the East.
"What did you learn?" Vestim said to her as they walked back toward the lead wagon.
"That Shin are odd."
"No,"
Vestim said, though he wasn't stern. He never seemed to be stern.
"They are simply different, child. Odd people are those who act erratically. Thresh and his kind, they are anything but erratic. They may be a little too stable. The world is changing outside, but the Shin seem determined to remain the same. I've tried to offer them fabrials, but they find them worthless, or unholy, or too holy to use."
"Those are rather different things, Master."
"Yes," he said. "But with the Shin, it's often hard to distinguish among them. Regardless, what did you really learn?"
"That they treat being humble like the Herdazians treat boasting," she said. "You both went out of your way to show how worthless your wares were. I found it strange, but I think it might just be how they haggle."
He smiled widely. "And already you are wiser than half the men I've brought here. Listen, here's your lesson. Never try to cheat the Shin. Be forthright, tell them the truth, and if anything, undervalue your goods. They will love you for it, and they'll pay you for it, too."
She nodded. They reached the wagon, and he got out a strange little pot.
"Here," he said. "Use a knife, and go cut out some of that grass. Be sure to cut down far and get plenty of the soil. The plants can't live without it."
"Why am I doing this?" she asked, wrinkling her nose and taking the pot.
"Because," he said, "you're going to learn to care for that plant. I want you to keep it with you until you stop thinking of it as odd."
"But why?"
"Because it will make you a better merchant," he said.
She frowned. Must he be so strange so much of the time? Perhaps that was why he was one of the only Thalans who could get a good deal out of the Shin. He was as odd as they were. She walked off to do as she was told. No use complaining. She did get out a rugged pair of gloves first, though, and roll up her sleeves. She was not going to ruin a good dress for a pot of drooling, wall-staring, imbecile grass. And that was that.
I-5 Axes the Collector. Axes the Collector groaned, lying on his back, skull pounding with a headache. He opened his eyes and looked down the length of his body. He was naked.
Blight it all, he thought. Well,
best to check and see if he was hurt too badly. His toes pointed at the sky. The nails were a deep blue color, not uncommon for an Amian man like himself. He tried to wiggle them, and, pleasingly, they actually moved. Well, that's something, he said, dropping his head back to the ground. It made a squishing sound as it touched something soft, likely a bit of rotting garbage. Yes, that was what it was. He could smell it now, pungent and rank. He focused on his nose, sculpting his body so that he could no longer smell. Ah, he thought, much better. Now, if he could only banish the pounding in his head. Really, did the sun have to be so garish overhead? He closed his eyes.
You're still in my alley,
a gruff voice said from behind him. That voice had awakened him in the first place.
I shall vacate it presently, Axes promised.
You owe me rent. One night's sleep.
In an alleyway?
Finest alleyway in Kazitor.
Ah, is that where I am, then? Excellent.
A few heartbeats of mental focus finally banished the headache. He opened his eyes and this time found the sunlight quite pleasant. Brick walls rose toward the sky on either side of him, overgrown with a crusty red lichen. Small heaps of rotting tubers were scattered around him. No, not scattered. They looked to be arranged carefully. Odd, that. They were likely the source of the scents he'd noticed earlier. Best to leave his sense of smell inhibited. He sat up, stretching, checking his muscles. All seemed to be in working order, though he had quite a few bruises. He'd deal with those in a bit.
Now, he said, turning, you wouldn't happen to have a spare pair of pants, would you?
The owner of the voice turned out to be a scraggly bearded man sitting on a box at the end of the alleyway. Axes didn't recognize him, nor did he recognize the location. That wasn't surprising, considering that he'd been beaten, robbed, and left for dead. Again.
The things I do in the name of scholarship, he thought with a sigh.
His memory was returning. Kazitor was a large Irialli city, second in size only to Ral Elarim. He'd come here by design. He'd also gotten himself drunk by design. Perhaps he should have picked his drinking companions more carefully.
I'm going to guess that you don't have a spare pair of pants, Axes said,
standing and inspecting the tattoos on his arm.
And if you did, I'd suggest that you wear them yourself. Is that a lavis sack you have on?
You owe me rent, the man grumbled, and payment for destroying the temple of the northern god.
Odd,
Axes said, looking over his shoulder toward the alleyway's opening. There was a busy street beyond. The good people of Kazitor would likely not take well to his nudity.
I don't recall destroying any temples. Normally I'm quite cognizant of that sort of thing.
You took out half of Hapren Street, the beggar said. Number of homes as well. I'll let that slide.
Mighty kind of you.
They've been wicked lately.
Axes frowned, looking back at the beggar. He followed the man's gaze, looking down at the ground. The heaps of rotting vegetables had been placed in a very particular arrangement. Like a city.
Ah,
Axes said, moving his foot, which had been planted on a small square of vegetable.
That was a bakery, the beggar said.
Terribly sorry.
The family was away.
That's a relief.
They were worshipping at the temple.
The one I...
smashed with your head? Yes.
I'm certain you'll be kind to their souls.
The beggar narrowed his eyes at him.
I'm still trying to decide how you fit into things. Are you a Voidbringer or a herald?
Voidbringer, I'm afraid, Axes said. I mean, I did destroy a temple.
The beggar's eyes grew more suspicious.
Only the sacred cloth can banish me, Axes continued. And since you don't... I say, what is that you're holding? The beggar looked down at his hand, which was touching one of the ratty blankets, draped over one of his equally ratty boxes. He perched atop them like, well, like a god, looking down over his people. Poor fool, Axes thought. It was really time to be moving on. Wouldn't want to bring any bad luck down upon the addled fellow. The beggar held up the blanket. Axes shied back, raising his hands. That made the beggar smile a grin that could have used a few more teeth. He hopped off his box, holding the blanket up wardingly. Axes shied away. The beggar cackled and threw the blanket at him. Axes snatched it from the air and shook a fist at the beggar. Then he retreated from the alleyway while wrapping the blanket around his waist.
And lo, the beggar said from behind, the foul beast was banished.
And lo, Axes said, fitting the blanket in place, the foul beast avoided imprisonment for public indecency. Ireale were very particular about their chastity laws. They were very particular about a lot of things. Of course, that could be said for most peoples. The only difference were the things they were particular about. Axes the Collector drew his share of stares, not because of his unconventional clothing. Erie was on the northwestern rim of Roshar, and its weather therefore tended to be much warmer than that of places like Alethkar or even Aesir. A fair number of the golden-haired Ireale men went about wearing only waist wraps, their skin painted various colors and patterns. Even Axie's tattoos weren't that noteworthy here. Perhaps he drew stares because of his blue nails and crystalline deep blue eyes. Amiens, even Saya Amiens, were rare. Or perhaps it was because he cast a shadow the wrong way, toward light instead of away from it. It was a small thing, and the shadows weren't long with the sun so high, but those who noticed muttered or jumped out of the way. Likely they'd heard of his kind. It hadn't been that long since the scouring of his homeland. Just long ago enough for stories and legends to have crept into the general knowledge of most peoples. Perhaps someone important would take exception to him and have him brought before a local magistrate. Wouldn't be the first time. He'd learned long ago not to worry. When the curse of kind followed you, you learned to take what happened as it happened. He began to whistle softly to himself, inspecting his tattoos and ignoring those observant enough to gawk. I remember writing something somewhere, he thought, looking over his wrist, then twisting his arm over and trying to see if there were any new tattoos on the back. Like all Amiens, he could change the color and markings of his skin at will. That was convenient, as when you were very regularly robbed of everything you owned, it was blighted difficult to keep a proper notebook. And so he kept his notes on his skin, at least until he could return to a safe location and transcribe them. Hopefully he hadn't gotten so drunk that he'd written his observations someplace inconvenient. He'd done that once, and reading the mess had required two mirrors and a very confused bathing attendant. Ah, he thought, discovering a new entry near the inside of his left elbow. He read it awkwardly, shuffling down the incline. Test successful. Have noted spren who appear only when one is severely intoxicated. Appear as small brown bubbles, clinging to objects nearby. Further testing may be needed to prove they were more than a drunken hallucination. Very nice, he said out loud. Very nice indeed. I wonder what I should call them. The stories he'd heard called them Suds Spren, but that seemed silly. Intoxication Spren? No, too unwieldy. Ill Spren. He felt a surge of excitement. He'd been hunting this particular type of Spren for years. If they proved real, it would be quite a victory. Why did they appear only in Erie? And why so infrequently? He'd gotten himself stupidly drunk a dozen times, and had only found them once, if indeed he had ever really found them. Spren, however, could be very elusive.
Sometimes even the most common types, Flame Spren, for instance, would refuse to appear. That made it particularly frustrating for a man who had made it his life's work to observe, catalog, and study every single type of Spren in Roshar. He continued whistling as he made his way through the town to the dockside. Around him flowed large numbers of the golden-haired Iriali. The hair bred true, like black Alethi hair. The purer your blood was, the more locks of gold you had. And it wasn't merely blonde. It was truly gold, lustrous in the sun. He had a fondness for the Iriali. They weren't nearly as prudish as the Voran peoples to the east, and were rarely inclined to bickering or fighting. That made it easier to hunt Spren. Of course, there were also Spren you could find only during war. A group of people had gathered at the docks. Ah, he thought. Excellent. I'm not too late. Most were crowding onto a purpose-built viewing platform. Axes found himself a place to stand, adjusted his holy blanket, and leaned back against the railing to wait. It wasn't long. At precisely 7:46 in the morning, the locals could use it to set their timepieces, an enormous sea-blue Spren surged from the waters of the bay. It was translucent, and though it appeared to throw out waves as it rose, that was illusory. The actual surface of the bay wasn't disturbed. It takes the shape of a large jet of water, Axes thought, creating a tattoo along an open portion of his leg, scribing the words. The center is of the deepest blue, like the ocean depths, though the outer edges are a lighter shade. Judging by the masts of the nearby ships, I'd say that the Spren has grown to a height of at least 100 feet, one of the largest I've ever seen. The column sprouted 4 long arms that came down around the bay, forming fingers and thumbs. They landed on golden pedestals that had been placed there by the people of the city. The Spren came at the same time every day without fail. They called it by name, Kusakesh, the Protector. Some worshipped it as a god. Most simply accepted it as part of the city. It was unique. One of the few types of Spren he knew of that seemed to have only a single member. But what kind of Spren is it? Axes wrote, fascinated. It has formed a face, looking eastward, directly toward the origin. That face is shifting, bewilderingly quick. Different human faces appear on the end of its stump-like neck, one after another in blurred succession. The display lasted a full 10 minutes. Did any of the faces repeat? They changed so quickly he couldn't tell. Some seemed male, others female. Once the display was finished, Kusakesh retreated down into the bay, sending up phantom waves again. Axes felt drained, as if something had been leached from him. That was reported to be a common reaction. Was he imagining it because it was expected, or was it real? As he considered, a street urchin scrambled past and grabbed his wrap, yanking it free and laughing to himself. He tossed it to some friends, and they scrambled away. Axes shook his head. "What a bother," he said, as people around him began to gasp and mutter. "There are guards nearby, I assume." "Ah, yes, 4 of them. Wonderful." The 4 were already stalking toward him, golden hair falling around their shoulders, expressions stern. "Well," he said to himself, making a final notation as one of the guards grabbed him on the shoulder, "it appears I'll have another chance to search for captivity Spren." Odd how those had eluded him all these years, despite his numerous incarcerations. He was beginning to consider them mythological. The guards towed him off toward the city dungeons, but he didn't mind. 2 new Spren in as many days. At this rate, it might only take a few more centuries to complete his research. Grand indeed. He resumed whistling to himself. I-6. A work of art. Zeth Sun Sun Valano Truthless of Shinovar, crouched on a high stone ledge at the side of the gambling den. The ledge was meant for holding a lantern. Both his legs and the shelf were hidden by his long enveloping cloak, making him seem to be hanging from the wall. There were few lights nearby. Makik liked Zeth to remain cloaked in shadow. He wore a form-fitting black costume beneath the cloak, the lower part of his face covered by a cloth mask. Both were of Makik's design. The cloak was too big, and the clothing too tight. It was a terrible outfit for an assassin, but Makik demanded drama, and Zeth did as his master commanded. Always. Perhaps there was something useful to the drama. With only his eyes and bald head showing, he unnerved the people who passed by. Shin eyes. Too round, slightly too large. The people here thought them similar to the eyes of a child. Why did that disturb them so? Nearby, a group of men in brown cloaks sat chatting and rubbing their thumbs and forefingers together. Wisps of smoke rose between their fingers, accompanied by a faint crackling sound. Rubbing fire moss was said to make a man's mind more receptive to thoughts and ideas. The one time Zeth had tried it, it had given him a headache and two blistered fingers. But once you grew the calluses, it could apparently be euphoric. The circular den had a bar at the center, serving a wide variety of drinks at a wider variety of prices. The barmaids were dressed in violet robes that had plunging necklines and were open at the sides. Their safe hands were exposed, something that the Bavlanders, who were Voren by descent, seemed to find extremely provocative. So odd. It was just a hand. Around the perimeter of the den, various games were in progress. None of them were overt games of chance. No dice throws, no bets on card flips. There were games of breakneck, shallow crab fights, and, oddly, guessing games. That was another oddity about Voren peoples. They avoided overtly guessing the future. A game like breakneck would have throws and tosses, but they wouldn't bet on the outcome. Instead, they'd bet on the hand they held after the throws and the draws. It seemed a meaningless distinction to Zeth, but it was deeply steeped in the culture. Even here, in one of the vilest pits in the city, where women walked with their hands exposed and men spoke openly of crimes, nobody risked offending the heralds by seeking to know the future. Even predicting the high storms made many uncomfortable. And yet they thought nothing of walking on stone or using stormlight for everyday illumination. They ignored the spirits of things that lived around them, and they ate whatever they wanted on any day they wanted. Strange. So strange. And yet this was his life. Recently, Zeth had begun to question some of the prohibitions he had once followed so strictly. How could these Easterners not walk on stone? There was no soil in their lands. How could they get about without treading on stone? Dangerous thoughts. His way of life was all that remained to him. If he questioned stone shamanism, would he then question his nature as truthless? Dangerous, dangerous. Though his murders and sins would damn him, at least his soul would be given to the stones upon his death. He would continue to exist. Punished, in agony, but not exiled to nothingness. Better to exist in agony than to vanish entirely. Makik himself strode the floor of the gambling den, a woman on each arm. His scrawny leanness was gone, his face having slowly gained a juicy plumpness, like a fruit ripening after the drowning's waters. Also gone were his ragged footpads garments, replaced with luxurious silks. Makik's companions, the ones with him when they'd killed Took, were all dead, murdered by Zeth at Makik's orders, all to hide the secret of the Oath Stone. Why were these Easterners always so ashamed of the way they controlled Zeth? Was it because they feared another would steal the Oath Stone from them? Were they terrified that the weapon they employed so callously would be turned against them? Perhaps he feared that if it were known how easily Zeth was controlled, it would spoil their reputation. Zeth had overheard more than one conversation centered around the mystery of Makik's terribly effective bodyguard. If a creature like Zeth served Makik, then the master himself must be even more dangerous. Makik passed the place where Zeth lurked, one of the women on his arms laughing with tinkling sound. Makik glanced at Zeth, then gestured curtly. Zeth bowed his masked head in acknowledgement. He slid from his place, dropping to the ground, oversized cloak fluttering. Games stilled. Men, both drunken and sober, turned to watch Zeth, and as he passed the three men with the fire moss, their fingers went limp. Most in the room knew what Zeth was about this night. A man had moved into Bornwater and opened his own gambling den to challenge Makik. Likely this newcomer didn't believe the reputation of Makik's phantom assassin. Well, he had reason to be skeptical. Zeth's reputation was inaccurate. He was far, far more dangerous than it suggested. He ducked out of the gambling den, passing up the steps through the darkened storefront, and then out into the yard. He tossed the cloak and face mask into a wagon as he passed. The cloak would only make noise, and why cover his face? He was the only shin in town. If someone saw his eyes, they'd know who he was. He retained the tight black clothing. Changing would take too much time. Bornwater was the largest town in the area. It hadn't taken Makik long to outgrow Stapland. Now he was talking of moving up to Kneespike, the city where the local landlord had his mansion. If that happened, Zeth would spend months wading in blood, as he systematically tracked down and killed each and every thief, cutthroat, and gambling master who refused Makik's rule. That was months off. For now, there was Bornwater's interloper, a man named Gavishaw. Zeth prowled through the streets, eschewing Stormlight or Shardblade, counting on his natural grace and care to keep him unseen. He enjoyed his brief freedom. These moments, when he wasn't trapped in one of Makik's smoke-filled dens, were too few lately. Slipping between buildings, moving swiftly in the darkness with the wet, cold air on his skin, he could almost think himself back in Shinovar. The buildings around him were not of blasphemous stone, but earthen ones, built with clay and soil. Those low sounds were not muffled cheers from within another of Makik's gambling dens, but the thunder and whinnies of wild horses on the plains. But no. In Shinovar he'd never smelled refuse like that, pungency compounded by weeks spent marinating. He was not home. There was no place for him in the Valley of Truth. Zeth entered one of the richer sections of town, where buildings had more space between homes. Bornwater was in a late, protected by a towering cliffside to the east. Gavishaw had arrogantly made his home in a large mansion on the eastern side of town. It belonged to the provincial landlord. Gavishaw had his favor. The landlord had heard of Makik and his quick rise to prominence in the underground, and supporting a rival was a good way to create an early check on Makik's power. The city lord's local mansion was 3 stories tall, with a stone wall surrounding the compact, neatly gardened grounds. Zeth approached in a low crouch. Here on the outskirts of town, the ground was spotted with bulbous rock buds. As he passed, the plants rustled, pulling back their vines and lethargically closing their shells. He reached the wall and pressed himself against it. It was the time between the first two moons, the darkest period of night. The hateful hour, his people called it, for it was one of the only times when the gods did not watch men. Soldiers walked the wall above, feet scraping the stones. Gavishaw probably thought himself safe in this building, which was secure enough for a powerful light eyes. Zeth breathed in, infusing himself with stormlight from the spheres in his pouch. He began to glow, luminescent vapors rising from his skin. In the darkness it was quite noticeable. These powers had never been intended for assassination. Surgebinders had fought during the light of day, battling the night but not embracing it. That was not Zeth's place. he would simply have to take extra care not to be seen. 10 heartbeats after the passing of the guards, Zeth lashed himself to the wall. That direction became down for him, and he was able to run up the side of the stone fortification. As he reached the top, he leaped forward, then briefly lashed himself backward. He spun over the top of the wall in a tucked flip, then lashed himself back to the wall again. He came down with feet planted on the stones, facing the ground. He ran and lashed himself downward again, dropping the last few feet. The grounds were laced with shale bark mounds, cultivated to form small terraces. Zeth ducked low, picking his way through the maze-like garden. There were guards at the building's doorways, watching by the light of spheres. How easy it would be to dash up, consume the stormlight, and plunge the men into darkness before cutting them down. But Makak had not expressly commanded him to be so destructive. Gavishal was to be assassinated, but the method was up to Zeth. He picked one that would not require killing the guards. That was what he always did when given the chance. It was the only way to preserve what little humanity he had left. He reached the western wall of the mansion and lashed himself to it, then ran up it onto the roof. It was long and flat, sloped gently eastward, an unnecessary feature in a late, but Easterners saw the world by the light of the high storms. Zeth quickly crossed to the rear of the building, to where a small rock dome covered a lower portion of the mansion. He dropped down onto the dome, stormlight streaming from his body. Translucent, luminescent, pristine. Like the ghost of a fire burning from him, consuming his soul. He summoned his shard blade in the stillness and dark, then used it to slice a hole in the dome, angling his blade so that the chunk of rock did not fall down inside. He reached down with his free hand and infused the stone circle with light, lashing it toward the northwest section of the sky. Lashing something to a distant point like that was possible, but imprecise. It was like trying to shoot an arrow a great distance. He stepped back as the stone circle lurched free and fell up into the air, streaming stormlight as it soared toward the splattered paint drops of stars above. Zeth leapt into the hole, then immediately lashed himself to the ceiling. He twisted in the air, landing with his feet planted on the underside of the dome beside the lip of the hole he'd cut. From his perspective, he was now standing at the bottom of a gigantic stone bowl, the hole cut in the very bottom, looking out on the stars beneath. He walked up the side of the bowl, lashing himself to the right. In seconds, he was on the floor, reoriented so that the dome rose above him. Distantly, he heard a faint crashing. The chunk of stone, stormlight exhausted, had fallen back to the ground. He had aimed it out of the town. Hopefully, it had not caused any accidental deaths. The guards would now be distracted, searching for the source of the distant crash. Zeth breathed in deeply, draining his second pouch of gemstones. The light streaming from him became brighter, letting him see the room around him. As he'd suspected, it was empty. This was a rarely used feasting hall, with cold fire pits, tables, and benches. The air was still, silent, and musty, like that of a tomb. Zeth hurried to the door, slid his shard blade between it and the frame, and sliced through the deadbolt. He eased the door open. The stormlight rising from his body illuminated the dark hallway outside. Early during his time with Makak, Zeth had been careful not to use the shard blade. As his tasks had grown more difficult, however, he'd been forced to resort to it to avoid unnecessary killing. Now the rumors about him were populated with tales of holes cut through stone and dead men with burned eyes. Makak had begun to believe those rumors. He hadn't yet demanded that Zeth relinquish the blade. If he did so, he would discover the second of Zeth's 2 forbidden actions. He was required to carry the blade until his death, after which Shin Stone Shamans would recover it from whomever had killed him. He moved through the hallways. He wasn't worried about Makak taking the blade, but he was worried about how bold the Thief Lord was growing. The more successful Zeth was, the more audacious Makak became. How long before he stopped using Zeth to kill minor rivals, instead sending him to kill shardbearers or powerful light eyes? How long before someone made the connection? A Shin assassin with a shard blade, capable of mysterious feats and extreme stealth? Could this be the now infamous assassin in white? Makik could draw the Alethi king and high princes away from their war on the Shattered Plains and bring them crashing down upon Yaakoved. Thousands would die. Blood would fall like the rain of a high storm. Thick, pervasive, destructive. He continued down the hallway in a swift, low run, shardblade carried in a reverse grip, extending out behind him. Tonight, at least, he assassinated a man who deserved his fate. Were the hallways too quiet? Zeth hadn't seen a soul since leaving the rooftop. Could Gavishaw have been foolish enough to place all of his guards outside, leaving his bedchamber undefended? Ahead, the doors into the master's rooms lay unwatched and dark at the end of a short hallway. Suspicious. Zeth crept up to the doors, listening. Nothing. He hesitated, glancing to the side. A grand stairway led up to the second floor. He hustled over and used his blade to shear free a wooden knob from the newel post. It was about the size of a small melon. A few hacks with the blade cut a cloak-sized section of drapery free from a window. Zeth hurried back to the doors and infused the wooden sphere with stormlight, giving it a basic lashing that pointed it westward directly ahead of him. He cut through the latch between the doors and eased one open. The room beyond was dark. Was Gavishaw gone for the evening? Where would he go? This city was not safe for him yet. Zeth placed the wooden ball in the middle of the drape, then held it up and dropped it. It fell forward, toward the far wall. Wrapped in the fabric, the ball looked vaguely like a person in a cloak running through the room in a crouch. No concealed guards struck at it. The decoy bounced off a latched window, then came to rest, hanging against the wall. It continued to leak stormlight. That light illuminated a small table with an object atop it. Zeth squinted, trying to make out what it was. He edged forward, slinking into the room, closer and closer to the table. Yes. The object on the table was a head. One with Gavishaw's features. Shadows thrown by stormlight gave the grisly face an even more haunted cast. Someone had beaten Zeth to the assassination. "Zeth, son Naturo," a voice said. Zeth turned, spinning his shard blade around and falling into a defensive stance. A figure stood on the far side of the room, shrouded in the darkness.
"Who are you?"
Zeth demanded, his stormlight aura growing brighter once he stopped holding his breath.
"Are you satisfied with this, Zeth, son Naturo?" the voice asked. It was male and deep.
What was that accent? The man wasn't Vaden. Alethi, perhaps?
"Are you satisfied with trivial crimes? Killing over meaningless turf in backwater mining villages?"
Zeth didn't reply. He scanned the room, looking for motion in the other shadows. None seemed to be hiding anyone.
"I've watched you," the voice said. "You've been sent to intimidate shopkeepers. You've killed footpads so unimportant even the authorities ignore them. You've been shown off to impress whores as if they were high light-eyed ladies. What a waste."
"I do as my master demands."
"You are squandered," the voice said. "You are not meant for petty extortions and murders. Using you like this, it's like hitching a Rashadium stallion to a run-down market wagon. It's like using a shard blade to slice vegetables, or like using the finest parchment as kindling for a washwater fire. It is a crime. You are a work of art, Zeth, son Naturo. A god. And each day Makik throws dung at you."
"Who are you?"
Zeth repeated.
"An admirer of the arts."
"Do not call me by my father's name," Zeth said.
He should not be sullied by association with me.
The sphere on the wall finally ran out of stormlight, dropping to the floor, the drapery muffling its fall.
Very well, the figure said. But do you not rebel against this frivolous use of your skills? Were you not meant for greatness?
There is no greatness in killing, Zeth said. You speak like a Kukori. Great men create food and clothing. He who adds is to be revered. I am he who takes away. At least in the killing of men such as these I can pretend to be doing a service.
This from the man who nearly toppled one of the greatest kingdoms in Roshar?
This from the man who committed one of the most heinous slaughters in Roshar, Zeth corrected.
The figure snorted.
What you did was a mere breeze compared to the storm of slaughter shardbearers wreak on a battlefield each day. And those are breezes compared to the tempests you are capable of.
Zeth began to walk away.
Where are you going? The figure asked.
Gavishaw is dead. I must return to my master.
Something hit the floor. Zeth spun, shard blade down. The figure had dropped something round and heavy. It rolled across the floor toward Zeth. Another head. It came to rest on its side. Zeth froze as he made out the features. The pudgy cheeks were stained with blood, the dead eyes wide with shock. Makak.
How?
Zeth demanded.
We took him seconds after you left the gambling den.
We?
Servants of your new master.
My oathstone?
The figure opened his hand, revealing a gemstone suspended in his palm by a chain wrapped around his fingers. Sitting beside it, now illuminated, was Zeth's oathstone. The figure's face was dark. He wore a mask. Zeth dismissed his shard blade and went down on one knee.
What are your orders?
There is a list on the table, the figure said, closing his hand and hiding the oath stone. It details all our master's wishes.
Zeth rose and walked over. Beside the head, which rested on a plate to contain the blood, was a sheet of paper. He took it, and his stormlight illuminated some 2 dozen names written in the warrior's script of his homeland. Some had a note beside them with instructions on how they were to be killed.
Glories within, Zeth thought. These are some of the most powerful people in the world. 6 high princes? A Selai Garantark? The king of Yakaved?
It is time you stopped wasting your talent, the figure said, walking to the far wall, resting his hand upon it.
This will cause chaos, Zeth whispered. Infighting, war, confusion and pain such as the world has rarely known.
The chained gemstone on the man's palm flashed. The wall vanished, turned to smoke. A soul caster. The dark figure glanced at Zeth.
Indeed. Our master directs that you are to use tactics similar to those you employed so well in Alethkar years ago. When you are done, you will receive further instructions.
He then exited through the opening, leaving Zeth horrified. This was his nightmare, to be in the hands of those who understood his capabilities and who had the ambition to use them properly. He stood for a time, silent, long past when his stormlight ran out. Then reverently he folded the list. He was surprised that his hands were so steady. He should be trembling, for soon the world itself would shake.
Part 3. Dying. Kaladin, Shallan. 29. Errorgans. The ones of ash and fire who killed like a swarm, relentless before the heralds. Noted in Masley, page 337. Corroborated by Coldwin and Hasava. It sounds like you're getting into Jasnah's good graces quickly, the Span Reed wrote out. How long before you can make the switch? Shallan grimaced, turning the gemstone on the reed. I don't know, she wrote back. Jasnah keeps a close watch on the soulcaster, as you'd expect. She wears it all day. At night she locks it away in her safe and wears the key around her neck. She turned the gemstone, then waited for a reply. She was in her chamber, a small stone-carved room inside Jasnah's quarters. Her accommodations were austere. A small bed, a nightstand, and the writing table were her only furniture. Her clothing remained in the trunk she had brought. No rug adorned the floor, and there were no windows, as the rooms were in the Carbranthian conclave, which was underground. That does make it troubling, the reed wrote. Ailita, Nan Balat's betrothed, was the one doing the writing, but all three of Shallan's surviving brothers would be in the room back in Yakaved, contributing to the conversation. I'm guessing she takes it off while bathing, Shallan wrote. Once she trusts me more, she may begin using me as a bathing attendant. That may present an opportunity. That is a good plan, the Span Reed wrote. Nan Balat wants me to point out that we are very sorry to make you do this. It must be difficult for you to be away so long. Difficult? Shallan picked up the Span Reed and hesitated. Yes, it was difficult. Difficult not to fall in love with the freedom. Difficult not to get too absorbed in her studies. It had been only 2 months since she'd convinced Jasnah to take her as a ward, but already she felt half as timid and twice as confident. The most difficult thing of all was knowing that it would soon end. Coming to study in Carbranth was, without doubt, the most wonderful thing that had ever happened to her. I will manage, she wrote. You are the ones living the difficult life, maintaining our family's interests at home. How are you doing? It took time for them to reply. Poorly, Ailita finally sent. Your father's debts are coming due, and Wikim can barely keep the creditors distracted. The High Prince ails, and everyone wants to know where our house stands on the question of succession. The last of the quarries is running out. If it becomes known that we no longer have resources, it will go badly for us. Shallan grimaced. How long do I have? A few more months at best, Nan Balat sent back via his betrothed. It depends on how long the High Prince lasts, and whether or not anyone realizes why Asha Jushu is selling our possessions. Jushu was the youngest of the brothers, just older than Shallan. His old gambling habit was actually coming in handy. For years he'd been stealing things from their father and selling them to cover his losses. He pretended he was still doing that, but he brought the money back to help. He was a good man despite his habit, and all things considered, he really couldn't be blamed for much of what he'd done. None of them could. Wikim thinks that he can keep everyone at bay for a while longer, but we are getting desperate. The sooner you return with the soul caster, the better. Shallan hesitated, then wrote, Are we certain this is the best way? Perhaps we should simply ask Jasnah for help. You think she would respond to that? They wrote back. She would help an unknown and disliked Vaden house? She would keep our secrets? Probably not. Though Shallan was increasingly certain that Jasnah's reputation was exaggerated, the woman did have a ruthless side to her. She would not leave her important studies to go help Shallan's family. She reached for the reed to reply, but it started scribbling again. Shallan, it said, this is Nan Balat. I have sent the others away. It is only Ailita and me writing you now. There is something you need to know. Luesh is dead. Shallan blinked in surprise. Luesh, her father's steward, had been the one who had known how to use the soul caster. He was one of the few people she and her brothers had determined they could trust. What happened? She wrote, after switching to a new sheet of paper. He died in his sleep, and there's no reason to suspect he was killed. But Shallan, A few weeks after his passing, some men visited here claiming to be friends of our father. In private with me, they implied they knew of Father's soul caster and suggested strongly that I was to return it to them. Shallan frowned. She still carried her father's broken soul caster in the safe pouch of her sleeve. "Return it?" she wrote. "We never did figure out where Father got it," Nan Balat sent. "Shallan, he was involved in something. Those maps, the things Luesh said, and now this. We continue to pretend that Father is alive, and occasionally he gets letters from other Light Eyes that speak of vague plans. I think he was going to make a play to become High Prince, and he was supported by some very powerful forces. These men who came, they were dangerous, Shallan, the type of men you do not cross, and they want their soul caster back. Whoever they are, I suspect they gave it to Father so he could create wealth and make a bid for the succession. They know he's dead. I believe that if we don't return a working soul caster to them, we could all be in serious danger. You need to bring Yasna's Fabriel to us. We'll quickly use it to create new quarries of valuable stone, and then we can give it up to these men. Shallan, you must succeed. I was hesitant about this plan when you suggested it, but other avenues are quickly vanishing. Shallan felt a chill. She read over the paragraphs a few times, then wrote, "If Luesh is dead, then we don't know how to use the soul caster. That is problematic." "I know," Nan Balat sent. "See if you can figure that out. This is dangerous, Shallan. I know it is. I'm sorry." She took a deep breath. "It must be done," she wrote. "Here," Nan Balat sent. "I wanted to show you something. Have you ever seen this symbol?" The sketch that followed was crude. Aelita wasn't much of an artist. Fortunately, it was a simple picture. 3 diamond shapes in a curious pattern.